We have a farm.
So we'll volunteer them for everything.
Good morning, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order.
And it's my pleasure to convene the House Revenue Committee. Welcome, everyone. Our business this morning, first off, is the December Economic and Revenue Forecast release by the Office of Economic Analysis. I think that we need to bring them forward and get started. Thank you, gentlemen. Much awaited prognostication.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Sir, Co-Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Mark McMullen and Josh Lehner from the Office of Economic Analysis. Thanks for having us today. It's always our pleasure to serve. I'm afraid for those of you on the committee, this is going to be frustratingly familiar insofar as we are in the same sort of limbo that we were 3 months ago, the last time we spoke. Insofar as the nationwide economists and other forecasters are becoming much more pessimistic, largely because of the developments in Europe, and have on a wide scale downgraded their outlook. But at the same time, here in Oregon, our story and narrative about this weak expansion we're going through, it's still holding up, and so far everything is really playing out according to script, both in terms of our lackluster labor market recovery as well as our strong growth in personal income taxes that we've seen that are still tracking along with the forecast and outperforming those in other states. So, again, much like last time, we're in a situation where revenues are doing fine and holding up well, and that the local economic data certainly appears to be playing out according to script, albeit a disappointing one. But given these risk factors, the risks of, you know, the downside risks are still uncomfortably high. And once again, the outlook for growth, you know, in the global economy and the U.S. economy as a whole over the next 2 or 3 years has been downgraded. And so it leaves us in a funny position insofar as we see our revenues doing quite well, as we expected them to, yet we are still going to make a marginal downgrade to the forecast. And to highlight that, we won't be getting through all of the reserves that were wisely left, but we are eating another chunk out of them. And so going forward, the margins are going to be a little bit leaner. So in terms of the U.S. Outlook as a whole, again, we're really seeing so far the expansion that we expected really start to play out. And the main feature of this expansion that we talk about is really that households are correcting their balance sheets after the housing crash and the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. And while they do so, increase their savings and pull back on their spending beyond their means, this puts downward pressure on consumption and growth. And so we're having a relatively slow recovery. But that said, we are having a recovery and an expansion. In U.S. and Oregon as well, we're seeing growth, and growth is being driven by business investment and exports and professional business services and the like, rather than the consumer, the American household, that has driven growth ever since World War II in this country. So we are getting growth, and we're getting it in the sectors we would expect, where the ones that we expected to be weak, in particular government, housing, and consumer spending, are fairly weak. But that said, you know, some of these have been somewhat encouraging lately. In particular, consumption and retail sales have started to come in above the expectations of most forecasting shops. And also, particularly in Oregon, it appears that a lot of the public sector job losses have also stopped, which will be, you know, a welcome change from the past year or two. And some of this reason why consumption could be strong, well, there are two big reasons why, and both are good, or somewhat good. The one being that there's a lot of pent-up demand. This is a cyclical phenomenon. Given where we are in the cycle, it's been many, many years since a lot of households have spent, or many, many months, that is, at least, since they've been able to spend. There's this forced austerity, both in households and firms. And particularly with firms, we've heard that, estimates of underinvesting by 20%, 30% over the last decade. So firms have a real need to replace their plants and equipment, particularly their technology goods, when the replacement cycle on tech goods is a very short one, sometime around 3 years for most computers and equipment. And so there's a tremendous need for businesses to invest, and we're seeing that. We're seeing investment grow at 15, 17% rates, and we're also seeing these exports grow at those rates. Now, in terms of consumption, pent-up demand helps, even though over the extended period, the American household certainly has to rebalance its spending behavior. But right now, at this point in the business cycle, a lot of households have to spend whether they want to or not. My example is my poor roof, which grows more moss year after year, and I spray it with junk to get rid of the moss, but every year it gets worse and worse. At some point, I'm going to have to replace that roof, even though our family is going through a rebalance right now where we're trying to spend less. And that's happening, I think, across much of America. And the reason they can, a lot of them, is that their upper-income families are doing most of the spending. And we see this in terms of the pattern of which retailers are doing well and which are doing poorly, where the high-end retailers tend to do better. And I think the story has to do with the balance sheet correction. And a lot of economists out there are now arguing that among affluent or high-income households, a lot of this balance sheet correction has already taken place. Default rates or delinquency rates on most types of credit cards, car loans, student loans, and the like, are back to where they were at pre-recession levels. Where we really see the problems in credit now are in these long-term mortgage delinquencies, 60, 90-day mortgage delinquencies, as one might expect. And really, that's where we've seen the improvement so far in consumer debt has all been in mortgage debt. And it's certainly not because households are spending or saving more. It's because many households are getting foreclosed, and so they lose. So the debt comes off their balance sheets. But nevertheless, we've seen, savings rates are back up to sustainable levels for many of the high-income households. And high-income households drive a lot of the spending in this country and certainly drive the revenue growth in Oregon. So, despite the fact that we're seeing growth really play out according to script, economists are becoming much, much more pessimistic. And as a whole, that degree of pessimism really can be tied to how much the given economist feels that Europe's financial problems will infect the rest of the global financial system. To what extent will Europe's problems derail our recovery and our expansion? And if you think it's a big deal, well, then that your probability of a recession is quite high right now. And why would that be the case? Well, for one reason, Europe's a big deal is because the U.S. expansion is so fragile. We're growing at a 1% or 2% rate. It really wouldn't take much of a demand shock to knock us back down. And, of course, the other reason is that Europe's a big place. It has a big interconnected financial system. It trades with a lot of the world. And so our real bad catastrophic scenarios here are exactly that, are terrible situations. And so this, of course, has many people concerned, because in the worst case, this could certainly set growth back by decades, not years. Another reason, and perhaps the most cited one, and Josh will go into this a little bit deeper in a minute, is the lack of a policy response, both in terms of the monetary policymakers, the Eurozone, the European Central Bank, and fiscal policy, where a lot of these countries, in order to get their debts in control, have been forced to undertake big austerity programs. while this over the long run is certainly a sensible thing, in the near term, given such a lack of demand, this, you know, the pullback in government spending and the lack of easy money, you know, threatens to exacerbate any recession that Europe has. And we do believe right now that Europe is in recession, and that is part of our baseline outlook. Now, it's certainly not a severe one and not one that would derail growth as a whole. And, of course, Josh will get more into detail, but European banks are those that hold the most European debt, as you might expect. And so their balance sheets, which have not ever recovered from the housing crisis yet, where the European banks never went through the sort of stress test exercises that the American banks did. There's a lot of debt on those books. Not only is there a lot of debt on those books that's visible, there may well be a lot of other financial instruments, both here and in Europe, that are essentially bets for or against currency. So while we may not have as much direct exposure as the European banks, there may be some hiding in there, nevertheless. So now, why would you think that Europe would not be as big of... why would you think that Europe wouldn't be of an issue? Well, I think a lot of the reason people are so concerned about the future here is that economists really see this current cycle in light of what we just went through. And it's very hard for us to not filter our observations through that. But this is clearly not 2008. U.S. banks are in better shape. They certainly don't, you know, they have a ton of capital right now. A lot of it is because they're afraid, but they certainly have a ton of capital and margins. While they're shrinking, profits are still in fairly good shape, and they do not have a lot of exposure, at least direct exposure, to European sovereign debt. And another reason this would be different is that it's a smaller section of the world economy. Europe's big. Even if you just look at the distressed economies or the peripheral economies that are in trouble, it's still big, but it's not as big as the U.S. consumer and certainly U.S. mortgage debt. And when the U.S. consumer gets knocked to their knees, certainly the global economy does. But it's not so clear that if peripheral European countries get knocked to their knees, the global economy will. This last recession was very unique insofar as it was coordinated across the globe and across regions in the U.S. And ever since the Great Depression, we've never seen something like that, where so many regions and so many countries went down simultaneously. Right now, many economists are calling for the same sort of cycle. And that certainly, and perhaps we are in a world of more globalization now and a more interconnected financial system, and in the future, cycles will be more coordinated, but it's not clear that that's the case. Another reason why the European woes might not infect our economy as much as feared is that a lot of these instruments were always considered risky, unlike the housing crisis, where we had towns in Sweden, you know, buying AAA mortgage-backed securities for their retirement programs. Around the sovereign debt has always been perceived as risky. Greece's credit rating never got higher than A, even at its very best. And so it's very unlikely that Ted Wheeler, or at least I hope, didn't went on a buying binge, you know, for our PERS. And then so because you know. When people buy these risky assets, they're, you know, certainly, hopefully that they're not doing so in anticipation of needing the liquidity in the near term. And finally, and I'll go down to the end, and really it's all about uncertainty to me. The reason the last financial crisis was so bad was that banks were afraid to trade with each other. No one knew which loans were bad, where the bad loans were, which banks were good, which ones had capital, which didn't. Here there's so much less uncertainty. Instead of having to value 50 million mortgages, we're talking about 5 or 6 countries. For the most part, we know where that stuff is. And so far, the financial financial markets have reacted as such, insofar as lending standards and risk premiums paid have gone up sharply in Europe, but not so far in the U.S. or in England, suggesting that banks so far are still willing to trade with each other and the financial system and credit is still flowing in a healthy manner in most of the world. So given how important this is for the near-term outlook, we're going to hammer on it a little bit more and then move on to Oregon.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, for the record, my name is Josh Lanner, Office of Economic Analysis. And as Mark was saying, the biggest risk here is the sovereign debt in Europe, primarily in the peripheral Europe. Here that's defined as the so-called PIGS, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain.
That's an economist joke.
The main issue is how much is out there and then who holds that actual debt. This graph here shows direct exposure, that is the actual sovereign debt of these countries, and then also some firm lending as well. So say a U.S. bank has a loan to a Greek company, that would show up as here as well, but primarily it is just the sovereign debt. And you can see the U.S. is about a third of the way across the horizontal axis. We have a little less than $200 billion in direct exposure to the PIGS, but as a percentage of our banking assets here in the U.S., that's about 5%. So while it's a big number, so we have a big financial sector or a big economy, it's not that large in percentage terms. You can see the United Kingdom is the same way. London, the city has a large dollar value of exposure to these countries as well. But again, they have a huge financial sector and large banks, so there's a percentage that's about 6% in there. Where you get some more concern would be further to the right of the scale, Germany and France in particular. Those are the two large economies in Europe. To combine, they're a little over half of the Eurozone GDP, and they hold the primary balance of a lot of the debt on these peripheral European countries, and it's a larger percentage of their banking assets as a result. So if these countries were to default on their debt, or they were to restructure it, or they were to leave the Eurozone, and there was a major credit financial event, you would look to the German and the French banks to see the biggest haircuts or the biggest defaults and the biggest losses on their books. And again, this is just direct exposure. There's all sorts of derivatives, and you heard about credit default swaps and that and the like. That is not shown in this graph. We know ballpark-wise, based on some other data, in the U.S., we have about $200 billion in direct exposure. There's credit default swaps and other derivatives. That's about $400 billion in additional. So that's U.S. investment houses underwriting these different swaps should an event in Europe occur. So this is definitely a lower bound on some of the exposure that we have across these different countries. And as Mark said, the buyer beware issue. This graph here takes the interest rates across all these different countries on the horizontal axis and benchmarks them against the U.S. rate on U.S. Treasuries, 10-year treasuries, 10-year debt across all these different countries. So a value of 1 means you have the same interest rate that the U.S. is currently paying on the debt here in the U.S. And it was updated this morning with the latest financial data. It really hasn't changed much in the last month or two. It has changed quite a bit in the past year or so, but in the past month or two, it has not. Some of these financial risks, some of these sovereign debt risks, appear to be priced into some of these different bonds and the different financial markets out there. You can see Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, they all pay the same or slightly lower on their 10-year bonds as what the U.S. government faces in the open markets. France is a little over 1.5, 1.75 times what the U.S. is paying, and that is some of a concern because they do hold a lot of the actual sovereign debt from the peripheral European countries, so that's part of the reason their spread's a little bit higher. Spain and Italy are a little bit better than a little bit better than junk. You can see the red bars, U.S. corporate junk bonds, somewhere around 8% right now is what their going interest rate is. So Spain and Italy are nearing junk status in terms of their interest paid on their debt. And then you can see Ireland, Portugal, and Greece, their interest rates are higher than U.S. corporate junk bonds. So we do believe some of these risks are priced into the current financial markets, and just one way of showing that.
Yes, quickly, because we're running
late. Thank you. The scale on the left is not the interest rate, it's the ratio.
That is correct, yes.
And what is the interest rate on U.S. baseline right now? About two?
About two. You know, 1.95 to 2.05, depending upon the day.
And that's about core inflation, isn't it?
That is core inflation, yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
So the upshot is we're sticking with the consensus of economic forecasters, or the vast majority out there, both in the U.S. level and among local forecasters and the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, in sticking with this disappointing anemic recovery, but not yet calling for outright recession. Again, a lot of the reason we're doing so is because of the pent-up demand in the economy. There are a lot of drags, including now a recession in Europe. But nevertheless, given where we are in the cycle, there's quite a bit of upward pressure as well. But the probability of recession is still uncomfortably high, somewhere, you know, subjectively in the neighborhood of 40% odds of a recession. So as such, contingency planning remains a must for the legislature, and we'll look a little bit at some of the downside scenarios at the end. But suffice it to say that, you know, the revenue losses in a recession are extreme, even though we wouldn't expect the recession to be a strong one, given that there isn't a whole lot of excesses built up. We haven't really recovered much from the last. Some of these cyclically sensitive industries, construction, auto sales, and the like, don't have very far to fall. So on to Oregon. In Oregon, our recovery, you know, has certainly been one that's been bouncing along in fits and starts. What we see here is employment, total non-farm employment, normalized to equal 100 in January of 2010, which was just about when it hit its bottom. The U.S. line is red. The Oregon line is blue. It wasn't a commentary about Oregon's political leanings. We have the, not intentionally at least, but as you see here, we certainly had a real gangbuster end of last year and heading into the spring. Oregon was growing great, headed right into the close of session forecast, of course. Things were going well, and economists in general were very optimistic at the time. But since then, over the last three quarters, we really have seen nothing in the state in terms of employment growth. That said, we have really seen some broad-based improvement in the state's labor markets. Most indicators are still weak, but they are steadily improving. And, you know, this is a whole laundry list of them, of unemployment claims and help-wanted advertising and hours worked per employee and the like. There's quite a bit to suggest that, to date, the labor market improvement has continued. But it's been very little improvement, and we've seen, you know, again, these very lackluster rates of growth relative to what Oregon has become accustomed to in periods of economic expansion. In the typical expansion, we get somewhere on the order of 3,500 jobs a month, and we are only seeing a little bit over 2,000 jobs a month during this expansion. However, if we net out two big problems, broadly related housing industries, which would be construction and real estate agents and mortgage lenders and home improvement stores and the like, and, of course, government, which is cutting at all levels, federal, state, and local, we see that the rest of Oregon's economy is growing like it would in a typical expansion. So that is certainly encouraging, and fits in line with our overall story and outlook for growth. Now, it also fits the picture regionally. While we say that there's a tremendous amount of evidence now that Oregon's labor market is stabilizing, that stabilization, that recovery has been very uneven across the regions of the state, with, in particular, much of rural Oregon being left behind. And how the different regions of Oregon have done can really closely be tied to these two main drags, the housing-related industries and the government. So the first slide here is to show how hard the different counties got hit by the downturn in 07 and 08. Green being good and red being bad. What we see is it's pretty clear here that the hardest hit areas were those at the epicenter of the housing downturn, Southern Oregon and the Bend area in particular. These places we saw unemployment rates increase by 10 or 11 percentage points. In at least in the Bend area, we were looking at double-digit increases in their unemployment rates. At the state as a whole, unemployment rates increased by 6.6% from their lowest point to their highest point, their lowest point being May of 2007 at a 5% unemployment rate, and then Oregon as a whole got up to 11.6 in June of 09 for an increase of 6.6%, whereas, of course, the Bend area, that increase was twice as large. The places that fared relatively well in the state also had to do with industrial structure. The best performing places happened to be those that were tied to agriculture. In particular, the Columbia Gorge not only had agriculture, but it was also supported by the building up of the wind energy infrastructure, as well as a lot of federal dollars for the construction of drones. We also had a lot of above average performance in the Willamette Valley, where the farms were doing well, and in the Portland, the greater Portland metropolitan area, where Portland has a big, diverse economy with a lot of avenues for growth, a lot of more industries than just the housing and the government. A lot of professional business services. Portland will have advertising agencies, whereas Harney County has very few. Now,
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. One question. I'm noticing the Oregon average, and I'm sorry, I thought you were done with the slide, but the average is 6.6%. That is the average unemployment rate for the state?
That is the percentage point increase. So that is the difference between the 11.6% high that was reached in June 09 and the 5% low heading into the recession. So the difference between those two rates is 6.6 percentage points. In the whole, the state had it increased by 6%, roughly.
And maybe you're going to, in a future slide, talk about that. How does that compare and benchmark with the rest of the United States?
In terms of the increase, it's roughly the same. Oregon went up a little bit more than the U.S., as it typically does. We're more sensitive to business cycles. But nevertheless, if you look over time, for more or less, Oregon stays a point or two above the U.S. unless we're in a turning point in the business cycle. But yeah, we did increase a bit more than the U.S. as a whole. Now, another way to look at it, and not so much how hard were the different counties hit in terms of how much higher their unemployment rates became, but how long it took between when we entered into the recession and when things got the worst. So how long were things getting bad and getting worse in these different counties? So this one shows the number of months between when the recession began and unemployment rates began to increase and when unemployment rates finally peaked. And this is really a mix. The duration of the pain is a mix between the industrial factors. Some of the longer ones had a long duration because of when they entered. And these were the epicenter of the housing downturn. In the spring of 06, the canary in the coal mine was really Southern Oregon. That's where we first started to see unemployment rates creep up, as the housing market was cooling off, followed shortly thereafter in the fall of 06 by, again, the Bend area, the greater Bend area. We saw start to worsen. So those are among some of the areas that have had a longer downturn. And then on the other end, the counties that are having a harder time coming out typically are those that are tied to government And in particular, these are our rural and our smaller population counties. As I mentioned, for Portland, Portland's diverse, has a lot of industries. It's not so much that the rural areas have big governments, but they don't have a diverse rest of the economy to offset. They all have K through 12 teachers and firemen and police officers, but they don't necessarily have ad execs and whatnot to balance out. So these areas tend to have a heavy exposure to government. And in the worst case, Baker County, we still have not seen an end to the increasing unemployment rate as the recession marches on.
I'm going to ask you to talk a little faster to get through this in our timeline.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So finally, in terms of how have we improved, this is all government, in a sense. And we do finally see some improvement in the hardest hit housing centers. These areas fell so far that these increases don't really make a difference in the pain, but at least it suggests that things are not getting worse. Now, the recovery has also been uneven insofar as a lot of low-income houses have missed out on it. And in particular, the difference between past business cycles is there is a larger problem with long-term unemployment. We've argued before, we typically say that, well, the 1980s was a more severe recession than this for Oregon in terms of the percentage job loss. We lost 12% of our jobs in the 1980s versus 8% in the most recent business cycle. But in terms of long-term unemployment, there is nothing like what we're going through now. Here I've compared our most recent 12-month period with a similar period. We don't have a long data series for Oregon here. But it suggests that these folks that have been unemployed by a half a year to a year are about twice as many as a share of the overall employed as they were in a typical business cycle. But really, the most encouraging thing in terms of the Oregon outlook is the lack of chatter in terms of layoffs. We have some real bad financial signals and some U.S. consumer confidence indices that are making a lot of people pessimistic. But one thing that is certainly getting better, again, are job markets. And it typically in Oregon, the one thing that makes me very, very encouraged is when we're heading into a recession, when we're 2 or 3 months ahead of a recession, typically we're going to hear a lot of chatter. We're going to see a lot of layoff announcements. This call center is closing. This factory is shutting down a shift. 200 jobs here, 500 jobs there. You start to see it in the papers, these anecdotes before we actually see job cuts. And it is really encouragingly quiet out there right now. We've had a couple. Some of the older established technology firms, HP and Tektronix, are talking about cuts, which would affect Corvallis and the Portland area. Eugene has lost some of its older facilities, the RV makers and the Hynix chip plant, which was the older generation of product. And finally, we had a smaller announcement just recently in Central Point of a crane maker. But compared with the wave of these that we saw going into the last two recessions, it's very encouraging. And this graph here shows the aggregate numbers. The Employment Department categorizes unemployment as three different ways you can become unemployed. You can either be laid off of your job, you can be a new entrant into the workforce, you're entering the workforce, or you could leave your job voluntarily. And so what this graph does is compare those who were involuntarily kicked out of their jobs to the number of folks who left their jobs voluntarily. And as you see here, there's been a tremendous amount of improvement in that ratio, suggesting, again, that at least so far, the chatter isn't there that it would look like we were, turning the corner on some major job cuts in the state. We think that if Europe's problems don't become too expansive and don't derail the global recovery, we feel that Oregon is in pretty good position to skate by. We Two main factors here. One is the lack of a large financial service industry in the state. We don't have big banks or investment houses, and so we'll be less hit by the shock to the financial system. And we don't have a lot of direct ties with trade to Europe. Of course, we do have a lot of indirect ties that we will ship some exports to Asia. They'll be fabricated into something or assembled and then sent to their final demander in Europe. But in general, we and the other Western states, excluding Utah and its gold exports, don't have a lot of direct ties to Europe. Our major trading partners are Asia, and so far, demand from Asia remains strong, aside from some noise in the chip market. So the flavor of this forecast hasn't really changed, at least in my tenure and the year before. Here we see our employment forecast from the past 2 years, with three of them highlighted. The green in the middle is the September forecast, the last one we presented to you. The red one is the new downgraded forecast. This was done in part because employment was not tracking the forecast. Following revisions yesterday, now it is. And also in part because of this gloomier outlook at the U.S. level, both from our vendor and from the Council of Economic Advisers, suggest that there will be less growth, if nothing else, just because of the recession in Europe. And so we've downgraded now to just about the lowest we've seen in the two-year period. The other one of note is the blue line, which is the highest we've seen over this two-year period, which unfortunately happens to be the close of session forecast that you all were working under. At that time, you can see the job market was rebounding very quickly and since has stalled entirely, leading to these downgrades that you've seen. But going forward, we're looking at continuing to muddle through. But that said, this downside scenario is still uncomfortably probable. We are looking, as you see this red line, the character of that is a somewhat mild recession again, because we haven't built up the excesses, but it would give back the 30,000 jobs that Oregon has gained since the bottom of the recession in 2009, and as we'll see later, would cost the state roughly $1 billion in revenue. So in terms of revenue, so far so good. Everything is working out well. Well, there are weak types of revenue, but the real workhorse, the personal income taxes, are doing really well. That's both in terms of withholding out of wages and salaries and these investment incomes. We're seeing strong double-digit rates as we have for the past year and a half, about what we expected. This is running roughly.
We have one brief question here.
Oh, sure.
On that personal income tax increase, how much of that is due to the increased withholdings that we implemented, I think it was last year, in the spring?
That is, it's a difficult question. We think it's about 100, it increased withholdings by about $130 million. Over the year, and the year as a whole. It's difficult to measure right now. There's a phenomenon in all states, not just Oregon, but all income tax states right now are seeing withholding growth far above our measures of wages and salaries or job markets, from our other economic sources. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but it makes it hard for me to disentangle if our estimates about the withholding tables are accurate, because it's clearly an issue everywhere. We're getting spillovers from these investment income and other sites of income, distressed income, like unemployment insurance claims and people cashing in their IRAs early and things like that, are splashing in, and they're getting some, in some cases, reflected as higher withholding. So withholding is rolling. We're looking at, we were going in the peak filing season at 10-12% rates. We've slowed down a little, but we're still at 8-9% withholding, you know, very strong for income tax takes.
But we really don't know how much of us just due to the fact that we increased withholding rates.
That's right. The fact that we increased it on wage earner households with wages below $50,000, which tend to be stable and relatively easy to predict. I think that this $130 million is probably pretty close.
Thank you.
On the downside, we've seen corporate income tax collections really start to drop. Now, we've been predicting this, but now that it's happening, it's still scary, and it's unclear how far they will go. And given that the new forecast suggests less profits, in particular among financial service industries, as banking margins get squeezed, corporate taxes end up getting hit the hardest in our outlook, in our newly revised outlook. Inheritance taxes remain low as well. A lot of these wealth losses have not been made up, particularly the housing wealth. We're seeing some growth, but nothing like what we were, not back to the levels of the pre-recession levels in any case. And finally, lottery revenues have been frustratingly weak ever since the recession and smoking ban went into effect. We have finally bit the bullet and went ahead and downgraded the longer-term lottery forecast as well, given how weak it is. But again, the saving grace is personal income tax collections. Here you see on a 3 month moving average basis through October, personal income tax collections still coming in at 15% year-over-year rates. Now, unfortunately, this isn't much of a surprise. We only got about 2% more than we expected, and some of that was due to some strong enforcement or some successful enforcement measures. But nevertheless, it's good. It's just we expected such strong growth, given that there was so much investment income earned in 2010 that had yet to be, come to fruit in terms of state revenues. But as was mentioned before, the corporate income tax collections have finally stopped coming in, and they're dropping. The only real question now is how far will they drop? We know, given they're so historically volatile, both the profits that underlie them and even more so the revenues that we as a state receive, we know that this huge boom that we've had is coming to an end, and that we are going to have some pullback from that. Really, the question is how much. And so right now, even in our optimistic alternative scenarios, we see some declines in corporate income taxes over the next year. Again, the forecast is tracking well, a bit above forecast in the personal income tax, 2%, although 1% of that error was, or half of that error was one particular enforcement case, and a very successful one apparently. And then the corporate, I probably said too much, the DOR is going to get mad at me. And the corporate income tax, again, is falling faster even than we expected, and that was a pretty quick deceleration we had in it. So here's the upshot. Here's the how much the forecast changed over time. And really, this personal income tax just follows the employment forecast at the national level more than anything else. Again, somewhat of a downgrade. We're looking at, including the lottery transfers, $107 million less than we expected in the current biennium. So less than a 1% downgrade, but from a Ways and Means perspective, a large $100 million. And going forward, those numbers get bigger as this weaker job outlook compounds over time, and then all of the non-wage income starts to be realized a year or two down in terms of collections. So really the timing just reflects the timing of when the collections are going to come in the door. And this one is to try to get in front of Representative Bailey's question. The forecast is down yet again. Four out of the last five forecasts for the current session, this is my tenure, have all been down, so this is on me. The highest, unfortunately, was the close of session forecast, and now we're down roughly 2% or $305 million from that forecast. So we've seen a couple of downgrades after this moment of crazy exuberance in the spring when we had all this wonderful job growth and the governor's council was very optimistic. The numbers are applied, and here is what it means in terms of your Ways and Means process. The number here is a little different. We've cut out the lottery transfer, but the revenue forecast is down roughly $300 million, and that comes out of the $440 million ending balance that was left at the end of the session. Over the longer term, we see a trend revenue growth weakening, along with the aging demographic. We're doing these 10-year forecasts now in keeping with the governor's push for a long-run budget process. Again, bearing in mind that the further we go out, the more likely these are to be wrong. However, I think the character in terms of the aging demographic and the impacts on growth, that pattern is likely to occur. Here is staring into the abyss. What happens if we do get this not so small 40% probability of a recession is realized? What would we be looking at? We went ahead and ran our recessionary scenario that you saw in the employment numbers through our income tax models, and this gives you somewhere on the order of $800 to $900 million in losses in the current biennium. These losses would be supplemented by another $100 to $200 million in all the other odds and ends in terms of revenue. We can't formally model those. A lot of them we get from different agencies, and we don't have a formal model for some of the ones that we take from the agency level. But, you know, roughly given their size, we can expect $100 or $200 million from the odds and ends revenue sources, in addition to the $800 to $900 million lost in personal income taxes. You know, unfortunately, hopefully we'll know by February, you know, if we're in this world. Nevertheless, you know, starting planning before the end of the biennium is near is obviously a must given the size of these declines. Here we see the revisions in the personal income tax forecast. Hard to see much different. Again, this in those middle years is $100 to $200 million in revenue, which is large from a spending perspective. But certainly from qualitative perspective, our income tax forecast is just marginally weaker. This isn't a sea change in thought the way a recessionary scenario certainly would be. And corporate taxes again are coming off of this forecast, coming off of this huge boom, and we know they're going to give some up. We have them giving up quite a bit more, and in terms of percentage changes, this is quite a bit more than the personal income tax. Again, we're hitting the banking sector. It was always our story. I've been downgrading corporate income taxes each and every forecast, and my story to you all in the past has always been, well, it keeps coming in above our projections, and so the longer this party goes on, the bigger the hangover we're going to have afterwards. Well, now it's dropping faster than projections, and we're lowering it anyway, I guess, just because this is what we like to do on the weekends.
Mark, but before you get too sunk in that hangover, we have a question here.
Thank you. With a lot of corporate taxable income kind of hovering around zero these days, because we've seen slight improvement in employment and also increase in income tax, individual income tax withholdings, could the downgrade in corporate income tax actually be a positive indicator that employment is increasing, therefore their profit, which has been hovering around zero, is now actually going down closer to zero or below? Is this not necessarily all negative?
I think she's asking, is there an aspirin in that hangover?
Is there an aspirin in that hangover?
Absolutely, Representative Brewer. I think it is, that's exactly what's happening, and that's why this profit cycle is what it is. When firms both invest and hire, you know, and they expand the cost ledger, here goes, you know, profits come down, and particularly taxable profits, because we give a lot of credits based on how much we've hired or how much we've invested in a given year. So absolutely, the profits coming down and hiring going up is exactly what we want to see. Not that we want to see profit margins disappear altogether, but we certainly want to see firms that are profitable chasing those by expanding.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
So here is the story. The final slide I think I'm going to talk about. It's revenue growth. This is just tax revenues. We've cut out the fees here for simplicity. But as you see, fiscal year 11 was a big year. We were at roughly 12% year-over-year growth. But unfortunately, the happy days are beyond us now. We're looking for about as much gain in revenue, about roughly $600 million over this biennium that we saw in fiscal year 11 alone. But as you see from the growth rates, the December forecast and the September forecast, while the December is downgraded some, the character is still roughly the same. We're looking at a pretty sharp deceleration in this revenue growth going forward. It's less pronounced, of course, as we smooth it on the biennial level. So with that, those are our prepared comments, and be happy to take any questions with the time we have remaining.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I guess my question would be focused on the, quote, pent-up demand, because what I have read would suggest that the consumer isn't going to lead us out of this. It would have to be business exports, maybe. Probably not government. So I'm just curious, how much of your future look is based on pent-up demand? I mean, the good parts of it. Because my thought would be, I hope not much, is my thought.
Yes, Representative Bentz. It's mainly a timing issue. When we argue for the pent-up demand, it's really a near-term phenomenon. It's certainly true that over this six, seven-year, actually, from the bottom, you know, recovery to get back to our peak, we are expecting slower than normal consumer spending and slower than normal growth on average throughout the period. What we're arguing for pent-up demand is simply that given where we are in the cycle, it's very hard to support a completely stagnant outlook where we just we're not moving at all. And I think certainly the corporate investment story is plausible. The consumer spending one, not so much necessarily. We're not banking a whole lot on it, but largely because the housing market is dysfunctional. Households that want to spend beyond their means largely can't. And so even though there is pent-up demand, it may not be fully realized.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Just a
Yes. Just a quick one. We're talking about global issues. As China, which has, of course, been growing dramatically for many years now, starts to look more like a mature state, that bodes well for our Pacific Rim exports, doesn't it? Long term, I'm not talking about immediately, but long term.
Yes, Representative Barnett, this is the positive development story, that what we've been going through in terms of shipping out capital and whatnot and outsourcing jobs will turn into higher wages for households in China, which then feed back into more demand for U.S. goods. And there's a lot to that. We've already seen the first steps of that with, in terms of the upstream suppliers. You know, our chip makers here supply computer assemblers in China now that used to be here, but nevertheless, the growth does increase demand domestically. So I think that is true, that there is a positive story there. There are also a lot of risks involved in those growing pains and that transition,
right,
which in my mind are probably even more looming than in Europe.
Right. And if I could just follow up, and some of those may be connected with policy decisions that governments make in the way in which they manage dumping and that kind of thing. Would that be an accurate statement?
Absolutely, Representative Barnett. There's a lot of the issues in terms of trade policy and also in terms of what we refer to as an imbalance in the current and capital accounts. We buy a lot of plastic stuff from China. They buy a lot of investment U.S. bonds from us. And many economists for 30 years have argued that this is not sustainable over the long run.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your coming in. We are going to, at this point, take a 15-minute recess. For those who have come for the next thing, we will promptly reconvene committee members at 9:15 and try and get through the rest of our agenda, 15 minutes in the hole. Thank you. We are in brief recess.
She knows the computer.
Yeah, we can. Kern, are we back? Okay, we are back in session of the House Revenue Committee.
Wait a minute, I'm in the wrong one then. Where's the Senate meeting?
Right here.
Joint House and Senate.
I'm it.
I'm sorry.
She's chair.
Fortunately, we don't have anything we are, we don't have any anticipated
work session. What am I, chopped liver? Thank you.
Or the Senate would be here instead. The next issue, we would like to hear from the Department of Revenue on this, on information on the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program. I know there's a lot of interest in this. We will be holding public hearings on this issue in January. We are in the process of scheduling it. So for those of you who feel like, wait a minute, I want to talk on this issue, you will be given an opportunity to talk on this issue before this committee. But today we would like to hear, we are information gathering. So our staff, Christine Roniak, will introduce this and where we are on this.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, the Department of Revenue has finalized the numbers for the amount of people who were affected by the new requirements of the program, both new applicants and existing participants in the program. The tax payments for November of 2011, the obligations of the program came to $9.8 million, all told. And so these numbers are, as they're finalized, going to help us to develop our revenue impacts of any changes that we might make to the program and just kind of have an idea of how many people are affected by those changes. And also, I'm working on some estimates of what it would cost, at least with the reverse mortgages, how commonly those would be paid back. And obviously, there is a liability there, and we're working to get a handle on, you know, the extent of that liability. But Department of Revenue will present their findings.
Thank you, gentlemen. Would you come forward? And please introduce yourselves before you speak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bram Ekstrand, and with me is Mark Kinslow. We're from the Department of Revenue. Paul Warner asked us to give you an update on the implementation of the new eligibility requirements for the deferral program. I would like to cover five main areas in this: a program overview, the new program requirements, disposition of the recertification process as we're moving through it, an update on the revolving account, and answer some of the previous questions that you have had. A little history on the program. The deferral program has been around since 1964. It was designed to pay the property taxes of low-income seniors and disabled. In exchange, a lien was placed on the property and the money was recovered when the taxpayer died or sold the property. In recent years, program participation has grown from 8,000 to over 10,000 in just 2 years. This increased demand on the fund combined with decreased repayments has resulted in an unsustainable program. The situation led to the passage of House Bill 2543. Some of the changes that came about from this new House bill: we now are requiring a real market value limit on the property, proof of insurance for the property, a minimum residency of 5 years in the home, a household income limit, exclusion of homes with reverse mortgages, a household asset limit test, and recertification of everyone active in the program every 2 years. Additional modification to the program was the switching from simple 6% interest to compound 6% interest on property taxes that are paid this November and going forward. Moving right into the recertification process, the part you are probably most interested in, we put together a number of charts here that kind of show the disposition of what we're seeing as we go through the thousands of these that have rolled in. Chart one on here shows the all participants and new applicants broken into three main categories. the blue being the active ones, the ones that have passed all the tests and been approved. And then the green and the red are those that were inactivated or denied. Just for terminology, inactivation are people who are currently active in the program but no longer meet the criteria to go forward with participation. Those would be ones that would be inactivated. New applicants to the program that haven't been on the program before are denied, just so that you're clear on that, what each pie chart means. Chart 2 explains the reason for the denial and inactivation, covering both the new and existing all in one chart. I won't cover every category on there. You can see it there. Two things I would point out. There's a significant percentage that just did not respond to our request for recertification, so we were not able to determine their eligibility, and those were inactivated.
And Brian, I remember when you last gave a report, we asked you to send a second notification to those folks, so these are folks that were notified twice.
Correct. Correct, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that, Madam Chair, we have had a significant number of people that have responded as a result of that second request for information. So every day we continue to receive additional recertification forms. So going forward, the percentage here of those that did not recertify will be diminishing. We're continuing to process those. Every one that we get in, we evaluate if they qualify for the program. We intend to pay the taxes for those people.
So you are still getting response from that second notification?
A significant number.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I could just follow up briefly, can you tell how the trends are with that second notification group? In other words, are they having a higher percentage of ineligibles, or have you made any conclusions about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Berger, the trends that we're seeing on the recertification ones, they tend to be more in compliance with the new criteria for the program. It seems that through the number of public information, press releases, our website, the news media coverage, people have a better understanding of what it takes to make the cut for the program. And there seems to be a lot of, in speaking with people that have called in, they've said, you know I don't make it because of I don't meet this criteria. I'm not even going to send in the recertification.
Thank you.
Chart 3 and 4 on the next page are expanded versions of the previous chart. Last time we presented, it was requested that we break out the existing participants from the new applicants so we could see if there was any real difference in the trends of these two groups. So 3 is representing those that we have inactivated that were already on the program. And chart 4 depicts the denials of new applicants.
Except that it says on chart 4, did not recertify, but these are not recertified. These are new certifies, are they not?
Even if they did the initial application, we sent them out a recertification form because it contained the questions regarding the new criteria. Since the original application season was January 1st through April 15th, the questions, the additional information we needed to determine their eligibility was not contained in that.
So new applicants maybe would be better put, these are people who have not been on the program in the past.
That would be correct.
Would that be correct?
That would be correct.
Chart 4. Okay, and in chart 3 are people who had been on the program in the past. It would be helpful to me. I don't know if anybody else. Thank you.
I can make that.
Excuse me, if I could. This orange wedge, then, these are people who didn't send the form in, or what is that group?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is exactly correct. Those are ones that we sent out the recertification form to, and we said we need this additional information to determine, and they did not respond for whatever reason.
Thank you.
Anything on those two?
Well,
yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It has to do with these denials, but the question I have has to do with the appeal process. Of these denials, how many appeal, and what can they appeal? I mean, what's the basis of appeal? Apparently, they're having to pay $240 to file the appeal. And on what basis would they be granted a reversal of the decision? I mean, it's pretty black and white to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, just to give you a broad overview, we have about 90 appeals right now that have gone to the Magistrate Division. We've already been working with them. We've looked at all the appeals, and probably 95%, if not more, of those appeals are surrounding the reverse mortgage. They are appealing because they just object to the new law. They're not appealing because anything has been administered incorrectly. It is just a objection on their part. With this population, we try to make our communications as simple as we can. I hate to see someone spend $240 and appeal on something when they're just looking for a way to vent their frustration or their disapproval of the new law. If there's anything that...
Graham, I know you're quiet and soft-spoken. Would you speak up just a little bit?
Of course.
For the sake of people who are interested in this.
If we're contacted by anyone who's looking to participate in the program and they say, you know, I was inactivated, but I think it was in error, or I sent in the incorrect information, we ask for the corrected information. They send it in. We can take care of that right there on the spot. There's no need for them to go through the appeal process, go through the case management, go through that whole thing. We can save them all those steps.
Paul, what would be the basis of the appeal for the 5% that you said could go forward?
The remaining 5% represents appeals over real market value.
Okay.
Yes.
And is that at the county level or you're at the state level, though?
That would be, the county is the one that establishes the real market value that we're using for the determination, but they are appealing to the Magistrate Division based on our determination of their ineligibility because they did not make the real market value test.
Okay. Yep, keep going.
But should you not be telling these people, save your $240, go to the county first and get the valuation changed or appealed, and then come back to us?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the value that's used for the termination is the previous year's certified roll value. So at the point at which we're making the determination, the deadline for them to appeal would have been December 31st of the previous year. Right. So there's nothing that at the county that they can do that would affect their eligibility for this year. What they should do is just, if they think their value is wrong, they should appeal it at any time.
Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to illustrate an issue that has come up with a constituent of mine as an example, not for you to address that particular situation. Constituent moved within 6 months ago and purchased a new house and was denied entry into the program because she hadn't lived there for 5 years. And during the course of discussing this, as she's reported it to me, the agency said, well, you can always appeal to delay your case and hope that the legislature changes their mind. And I have a concern about that because she hasn't lived there for 5 years, and we can look at the deed and the date it was recorded and know that she hasn't lived there for 5 years and doesn't qualify for the program. And if she can't afford the tax, it's a complete waste of a $240 appeals fee hoping for a legislative solution. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention, not to rake you over the coals, but please don't do that. If you have, I'm not saying you have, but please make sure that people are understanding that this is not a delay tactic, that this is not a lobbying tactic, that is not the right way to go. And a question is, do you have an ombudsman or a person that you refer them to that can give these folks legal advice so that they're not wasting their money?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, what we've been doing is working with the magistrate division on figuring out the best way to communicate with these people that have appealed and make it clear to them.
Ram, you're going to have to move that microphone a little closer or speak up.
Sure thing.
I'm thinking of the audience outside this room who wants to hear you.
Of course. There's the misconception among many people that have appealed that since they have appealed, they are not responsible for paying their property taxes that were due November 15th. And so we've worked with the magistrate division and all of the staff that we have. We've tried to make it absolutely clear to convey to them that even though they have appealed, it is still their responsibility to pay their property taxes. As for giving people, we definitely do not want to give people false hope in situations that just because they've appealed, especially since in 1 year the residency would not change to greater than 5 years, it sounds like, in this situation. So they would still not qualify. But I would be happy to reiterate that with staff to make sure that everyone's on the same page.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to follow up on Senator Telfer's questions. I think what you said is that while you use the statement of value that the county has given you from the tax rolls, the magistrate would have the authority to establish a different value on an appeal. If someone were to appeal the value, and because that the value was the reason why they were denied. Have I got that right? If the actual market value is different than the one that the county determined last year, or back in January, before January of this year, and the claimant was able to establish that fact, presumably if that brought them under whatever the amount is in that county, that would allow them to participate in the program, despite the fact that on the tax roll, the value of the property is higher. Is that correct or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, so just so I understand the question correctly.
Let me put it a different way.
Thank you.
An appeal based on the issues that Senator Telfer raised could be effective if they could establish that the facts were different than what you thought the facts were based on the tax roll.
My understanding is that they would have had to appeal by December 31st for the assessment date of 1/1/2010. They would have had to appeal by December 31st, 2010. If they did not appeal by that timeline, then that value would be fixed.
And the value is fixed because?
That would be the last certified roll value.
Right. And if I could follow up, does the statute or the rule require that the certified value is conclusive proof of what the value is? I mean, is that the way it's established, or do you use that as a matter of convenience?
The statute directs us to use the last certified roll value.
Okay, that answers the question.
Yes.
So, in fact, well, excuse me just a moment. So, in fact, when a person comes in and has a concern about the value, it didn't really matter before we passed the statute because they were paying taxes based on the assessed value, not the real market value. If they have a concern about that and they think the value is actually lower than what the assessor has, they're out of luck for the current tax year, but they could appeal for the next tax year now before January 1 to the county to get that market value established at the correct level. Have I got that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Burnett, that is exactly correct.
Well, that opens up the further question that says, then what is this 5% that's moving forward on the appeals? You said 95%, you know, you kind of kicked out because they didn't fit the criteria. So what is this 5% that still has a glimmer of hope
that they're going to be able to appeal the decision that they don't qualify. I thought it was the one, I thought you said they were appealing the value, and yet we just established that that's pretty cut and dry.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we believe that is pretty cut and dry, but they would like to move forward, it sounds like, on hearing those appeals. That's not our call on that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just an additional follow-up, really quickly. Does that mean that somebody thinks that this is an open question, that the magistrate might disagree with what we've just been discussing?
Madam Chair, Representative Hart, I haven't received any indication that that would be the case.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Representative Gelser has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a follow-up to these questions, I share the concern about the potential loss of $240 to the taxpayer. However, is that $240 covering all of the staff time and administrative hearing time to process these appeals, or are we creating an additional expenditure within an already oversubscribed program that we could be using to address some of these problems?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser.
Speak up, Brom.
I think that I would like to, I know that there's a provision where that someone can apply to have that fee waived, and a number of people have applied and been had that fee waived on their behalf. As for the $240 covering the administrative costs of all this, I don't know definitively, but I would highly doubt the $240 would cover that.
May I follow up, please?
Yes,
Madam
please.
Chair? I guess I would just add my voice to not understanding why these appeals are moving forward at all. If it's cut and dry, it's costing poor people money, and it's costing the state money that we can't afford to spend, and costing the time of talented staff that could otherwise be putting their talent to greater use in our public system.
If I could, people have a right to spend their $240 on a quest to get their opinion heard in a different venue. I think what I'm hearing the Department of Revenue say, and I hope what I'm hearing them say, is that they are not giving them hope, but they are saying you do have this avenue. Am I correct in that? You are not saying, well, you can always appeal this, go ahead and spend your money, you might win. I hope they're saying we don't think you're going to win at all, but here is your next step.
Yeah, I hope
that's what I'm hearing. Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's to be sure. I mean, you have due process rights. You have the Administrative Procedures Act, and we have to tell them that they have the right to appeal by statute. But and where my concern is just making sure that we're not intentionally or unintentionally leading people to believe that there is some benefit to delaying the process by appealing.
Right.
And that's where we get into a realm that makes me very, very uncomfortable, because it sounds like legal advice and it's not right. So as long as we're not doing that,
yes,
okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Juan, I can assure you we try to be crystal clear in our communications with them that the appeal route is not a good forum just to object to the policy or the new law.
Yeah, that's right.
With this population, sometimes it's they want to be heard, and they want to, that's their right. And so we give them the information that they need if they wish to appeal.
Further discussion on this? Okay, we'll move on.
I think we covered charts 3 and 4, unless there's any questions on those. On page 4, last time we presented here before the committee, there was a question about overlapping disqualifying criteria. So we decided to look at the largest disqualifying criteria, which was reverse mortgage. And a lot of participants have, not a lot, but a number of participants have additional disqualifying criteria. So that if we were to take away the reverse mortgage disqualifying criteria, they would still be ineligible to participate in the program for a number of other reasons. So we've created two Venn diagrams here. the top diagram showing the overlap of new applicants and other criteria which would still make them ineligible, and then the bottom diagram shows the existing pool of participants and the overlap there.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clarification, take that first chart as an example, residency test, 88 accounts. Is that 88 accounts that overlap, or is that a total of 88 accounts that fell out because of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, that is 88 accounts that overlap. So those are ones that have reverse mortgage and they failed to meet the 5 years of residency.
So if you follow up, Madam Chair, so if you add up these numbers, let's say on that top chart, and subtract it from 326, then you'd find out the total number of people who only have reverse mortgage, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, that would be correct, as long as there's not multiple disqualifying criteria. Say someone has a reverse mortgage, and they don't have insurance, and they didn't make the RMV test.
This duplication issue gets very tricky very fast when you have a number of criteria. Yes, you had a question.
I was just going to say, if I did the math right, and the two CPAs here without our calculators,
separating you.
No, I think actually it's good.
Just give us a calculator.
So the denials and inactivations purely from reverse mortgages then is no longer 2,071. I think it's closer to just shy of 1,700. And I don't say anything from a judgment on that as much as that's probably more of the pure data with the reverse mortgages. Yeah. They would be otherwise disqualified anyway.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Erber, in fact, if you wanted to move on to the next page, page 5.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. Another question we had last time here was to look at the breakout of reverse mortgages by county, and then separate it between new and inactivated who are existing participants.
Okay.
You see the complexity.
That doesn't correct for the...
Well, but I think what you're misunderstanding is that this Venn diagram is only useful to a point. You can't just do a straight subtraction because there could be multiple reasons for any one applicant to have... They would fit in. There's basically five categories there in that first Venn diagram. Any one applicant could hit one, two, three, or five of those categories. So you can't just subtract out applicants on a Venn diagram.
Okay.
Am I correct in that?
You are correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So then the math that I just did was wrong. I was happy to do that. What I'd like to know then, can you tell me, and maybe it is the 2071, I just want to clarify and understand, the number of reverse mortgages, applicants that were denied in either population, currently existing or new applicants, that were denied solely with no other overlapping criteria that they didn't make solely because of reverse mortgages?
Take the number to have.
That doesn't tell me that could be it.
Do you have that data?
This is their total.
Well, that's the one existing.
Could you provide that data to us at some point, please?
Madam Chair, we certainly can.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go on.
We'll get that data. This is an outgrowth of the fact that our phones have been ringing fairly steadily on this issue. Thank you very much.
I can relate, Madam
Chair. And we have been desperate for data.
He tells them to call us.
Yeah. The newspaper tells us call us.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I could just simply add, when we wrote this bill, we didn't have any of this data. And so we're really starved for getting as much as we can so that we can understand what the possible fine-tuning might be for this program.
And that is a very good point, one that I have made many times on the phone. No, I did not know you had a reverse mortgage, personally. This was not data that's been collected. But we know what it does to the numbers of the program, and that is the basis for our policy decision. It is not a personal affront to anyone, and I can tell you that many have felt that it was, but I didn't know how many people had a reverse mortgage. In fact, it was a shock to me how popular this instrument has been in the last just few years. We have more information on that, by the way, coming later today. Okay, you want to continue? Are you done?
We can move on, Madam Chair. I already touched on the breakout by county. Any questions on that? If not, I'll move on.
Okay.
The very last page here, we provide a little bit of information about the revolving account status. As you well know, in May, we had to zero out the account to pay the remaining one-third that was due to the counties. We forecasted repayments coming in about 1.2 a month. Repayments actually came in a little higher. We had just over $8 million at the end of October for payments. We received Senate Bill 939 gave us additional funds so we could pay our property tax obligation to the counties. Then there's two charts below that. The question was asked last time we were here about if we were to pay on reverse mortgages. And so we had our research section do some calculations on that, what it would cost to pay on those that were active in the program that were inactivated because of reverse mortgage, what that cost would be. And then there was an additional question asked, well, if we pay on not only those that were inactivated, but those that applied during 2011, the new applicants that were denied because they had a reverse mortgage, what would it cost if we went back and paid on those also?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. This has to be more about rate of repayment. Just looking at the first chart, which is materially consistent with the second chart, but I mean, it's the methodology is consistent, but the numbers are materially consistent. So if I were to look under the current law, which excludes reverse mortgages, again, assuming that these are these reverse mortgage people are excluded purely because of reverse mortgages and no other overlapping criteria, and then I compare that with if we add back in the existing applicants that have a reverse mortgage, we are paying out over these 4 years, if I've read it right, an additional $15.7 million, but yet the repayments are only at $3.1 million increased. And I'm assuming that's the increase from the reverse mortgage population. I don't see the repayment growth is not happening at the same rate as the increase in reverse mortgages. Can you talk to me about the rate of repayment of reverse mortgages versus non-reverse mortgages? There seems to be some kind of disparity in that. And I know it's a big question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we would have to. Right now, we don't have the accounts identified as those who have had reverse mortgages tied to repayment history. Now we do know who has reverse mortgages and who does not, but we just learned that as of this year. We would have to take that, identify those that have reverse mortgages, and try and go back and look at the repayments associated with those individuals to see if there's a difference.
A follow-up statement. That does, somehow this data was extrapolated, and that goes to the heart of what we're struggling with reverse mortgages, and that's the ability to repay. And so that this chart validates our concern at first blush. And so I want to ferret that out a bit more. And again, that is a big question, but this is exactly why we excluded to begin with, mm-hmm. Because of the inherent risk to the underwriting taxpayers. And so this trending is what concerns me and validates our concern. And so when we want to go back and fix it, we just have to be extremely cognizant of the risk. And somehow this is based on some data that you've got.
Madam Chair, Representative Erber, I have three additional pages of technical detail that backs up these numbers. And I would be happy to provide that to the committee later.
That would be good.
That would be good. I would assure you, senators and representatives, that our legislative revenue staff, who does these kinds of analyses, has been part of this, and I think we will continue to get this data refined. But we have never asked these questions of our participants before, so this is all new data. We just knew income and age, and that was the qualifier, and we have never asked for any of this data before. And so we are grappling with tr- trying to manage and understand it all. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last meeting we had a presentation that kind of showed on the average where the reverse mortgages.
We have a presentation on that from our staff at the conclusion of this presentation.
Well, then, let's get there.
Well, I it is.
Finish these pages.
Well, this, and I hope if your question does not get answered in this presentation, please come back to it. Okay, I just don't. Okay. I just want, we hopefully will get there. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one thought on when we talk about the lien in these papers, it would be really helpful, if possible, to consider using the word subordinate, because I think it almost always is, and it's really confusing. If we have real taxes which are not subordinate, and we have this which is. That's just a comment. My question is actually based on a constituent, very angry one, who emailed me and wanted to know why we had been so abrupt in what we've done. And it reminded me quite a bit of some of the discussion on the Betsy, where we were trying to wind down a program that was way too exciting for folks. And I just want to know how I respond to this lady. Do I say to her that we were right on time, we really didn't know we had a problem, and when we saw it, we jumped in immediately and passed this bill? Or are we more at fault than that? And how we, our identification of the problem and then our addressing it.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, we first identified a downward trend in the revolving account in 2009. We started identifying characteristics of the account and looking for solutions at that time.
Representative Benz, I will offer up here that over a year ago, I was contacted by John Phillips, the Department of Revenue, and told we have a serious problem. The numbers look like this program will go to zero within the next cycle, which would be right now. Senator Telfer and I started a process of looking at possible solutions, but it was pretty clear to us this was a legislative issue, one that would require a more than what we could do over the phone. And as a result, as you well know, there have been a series of meetings and public hearings that we have brought this up, and a work group who has been working, and the solutions that we came forward with as a leader in that, our goal was to save as much of this program as we could, knowing that the numbers were going to zero in a hurry. So it was not that we were not alerted by the Department of Revenue. We were. Could they have done it sooner and we'd done it in a previous legislative venue? I don't know. The legislature tends to work on the problem before us, not the one that we think might come. And it is true that we did not pass this legislation until June, and that left the Department of Revenue trying to gather this information and do it all in a very short timeline. That being said, I think we're all been hammered pretty hard all the way around. I hope that helps your question as to the timeline.
It does. I think the an answer that I think is a good answer, and I will relay that to her. I am just wondering if these programs, and I'm hearkening back to the Betsy, shouldn't contain something that says this isn't guaranteed, and it's when you rely upon the government, you do so at your own risk, and things to of that nature. I'm just saying that when we create a program of this like this, most people assume it's going to go on forever. And that assumption in this case, at least, wasn't correct.
I totally get that. I think all of us couldn't imagine the turn in housing that we have witnessed since 1962. I have not experienced anything but an uptick, you know, occasional little bumps, but not an uptick. And that's what this program was based on. And you're absolutely right. There are only two things that are sure in this world, and we know what they are. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This seems an opportune time to add a comment. I think that we did important work in addressing this issue last session, and I know that we've all been hammered by it. I know that I'm concerned about some of the stories that I've heard from individuals who are very poor seniors that are not sure how they're going to hold on to their homes. And I hope that we can do whatever we can to address the needs of those individuals. That said, as Representative Ayer mentioned, this data points to why we had to make these choices. We had a program that was insolvent and that was falling apart. And if you look at this issue, our housing issue, it is not just restricted to seniors. And we need to look at our responsibility to all of the people in the state of Oregon and how our expenditures on the tax expenditure side impact our services on the spending side of the ledger. There's nothing in this program that addresses the thousands and thousands and thousands of families in their 20s and 30s who are saddled with more student loan debt than any generation before them because of our disinvestment in higher education, who are suffering in this economy, working hard, playing by the rules, looking for jobs. They can't get them. They don't have the money to feed their kids. They don't have access to Medicare. People in their 20s and 30s don't have access to guaranteed universal health care. And we have no program like this for the younger people in our generation to go and figure out how they're going to take care of their kids and how they are not going to be forced out of their house, not into a facility, but into a tent in a local park. So I think that as we're looking at this issue, we have to recognize that we have thousands of Oregonians that are hurting of all ages, and we have to do what we can to help those who are in poverty, because these costs are going to expand, and we can't focus it just on one generation. We need to help our most vulnerable seniors, but we also need to help our most vulnerable families and our most vulnerable kids. And we can't lose that when we're doing this important work, which is hard. Sometimes we do very hard things, but it's our responsibility, and we have to do it.
Thank you. Thank you. Further comments at this time? I think, do you have any other remarks on this?
No, Madam Chair.
Chart. Any further questions on the data before us? If you would like further or expansion of these numbers, I am sure that you folks would be quite willing to sit down and we can delve deeper. But I think the negative balances over here speak for themselves. And also I would like to point out that under your bullet point, the transfer from Treasury of $19 million was a loan that we will be paying back to the taxpayers. That was not free money that we used to make this program solvent. Did you have anything further, gentlemen? I think maybe you could stay in the room. And,
of course.
If there are further questions, and Christine has some further information on reverse mortgages, because I think we all know in the February session we will be talking further about this.
So I just wanted to go through very briefly some information updates that I have come up with within this reverse mortgage data. Obviously, the end goal here is to get to the ability of the holders of a reverse mortgage to pay at the end of their senior deferral period. And one of the statistics that I would use to try to determine that is what I call the lien ratio, which again is the ratio of the reverse mortgage lien to the property value. And this is the measurement of the amount left in the estate after a reverse mortgage is finished. This lien ratio had been staying relatively consistent over time, until about 2008, 2009, and 2010, where we do see that it starts to slide. And this is, of course, in response to declining home values due to the housing crisis.
Christine, is this national data?
Correct.
Thank you.
And I had actually compared that also to Oregon data, which it's relatively similar, the patterns the over time in Oregon and nationally. But the national data set has a larger sample size, so I like to use it for these estimates. You can see here that here's a frequency plot, you know, of the average amount retained in lien to house value. In 2000 and 2005, the peak is around, you know, 0.5 to 0.6. And then you kind of see a troubling trend as it comes out toward the most recent years in 2008, 2009, and 2010, where that peak actually moves up to 90%. And that means typically that ratio is going up to 90%, that that house value only has 10% left at the end of a reverse mortgage period. And since the lien that the program has is subordinate to the reverse mortgage lien, obviously they can only work at this point with what is left over. So then I used some projections of how home values are going to proceed into the future to come up with some scenarios. The baseline would be the OEA projection of the Oregon Housing Price Index. This is a dip in 2012 followed by a recovery. There's another scenario where the housing prices are simply stagnant, where that 2012 dip is followed by no recovery and house prices stay the same. And furthermore, there's a pessimistic scenario where house prices continue to decline at the rate between 2011 and 2012 out into the future. And, you know, there's the question of what repayment would require. Approximately $2,500 per account, the average balance of the program end would be $22,000. The average reported real market value is $177,000 on the property. So that means that 13% of that real market value must be recovered in order to pay off the lien at the end. So you can see here this lien ratio and what it means, how it actually translates to the amount of money that is available at the end of the reverse mortgage period. Right around 0.85, so that's 85% of the housing value taken up by reverse mortgage and 15% left to the program, the value remaining would exceed the liability. But then as you move into 90%, the value remaining it drops below the liability and the program begins to take a hit on the repayment and the ability to repay. So that ability to repay is modeled out into the future along these three scenarios, and this is what will be used to generate the cost of keeping the people in the program or potentially making some changes related to reverse mortgages. And it gives us an idea of the exposure to liability for not having potentially not having all these liens paid at the end.
Representative Ayer.
Thank you. I just to point out, though, on these lien ratios and the scenarios you've done, it's taken the average remaining value less the liability, but doesn't take into account the cost of disposal of the house, the sales cost, which can be another 5%+ for real estate fees and so on and so forth. And so that means that the lien ratio then, you're showing it above water at 0.85, but it actually is at an earlier or at a much lower lien ratio becomes questionable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that true? That's true. Account for the closing costs?
Sales costs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Further questions? Was this helpful to your question, Senator Telfer? Was this the kind of information you were looking for, and what further information would you like to have?
Well, I was the question I had was, we just ask, do you have a reverse mortgage or not? We don't ask anything about
lien rate.
And I'm not sure how we would even ask that question somebody on the program. How would we even ask? How would they answer the question? How would they know how to answer the question?
Well,
some might, but I can tell you most wouldn't have a clue what their lien ratio
is. In discussions with your co-chairs on both sides, this is one of the things that we believe we will be taking up in the February session in a serious way. How could we get at this?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In what way? And then, of course, the administrative cost of that,
right.
The juice worth the squeeze. And when you ask for huge volumes of information, you have to have someone who receives it, analyzes it, and decision makers within the agency. And that is a question that we have to ask. And then the difficulty in deriving, cogent information and monitoring. These are all things that I believe we will be talking about in the February session in a serious way. So I'm asking now for you, as committee members, to think about
what kinds of questions you will have, your thinking on this, and so staff can anticipate the kind of information that they need to be getting to us for these kinds of decisions in February.
Well, just another piece of input then, in that the fee, the appeal fee went from $75 to $240, and we heard that that may not be covering the cost of processing these appeals, even though only 5% are moving along. So if we're asking for more analytical analysis, that's pretty redundant, but more work on the part of the Department of Revenue in trying to determine lien ratios and all the criteria. Obviously, there's going to be more cost, less money to be utilized in paying taxes. So, we have to weigh that, too.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another piece of information that I is still foggy in my mind is on these reverse mortgages. It would be good to get some data of as it affects to the population in this plan. Those that have a fixed debt versus those that have a moving debt with a line of credit or able to take out monthly withdrawals. So the lien ratio isn't necessarily stagnant. So if we could get some clarification of the demonstrated activity on reverse mortgages in those two.
And Madam Chair, just to add to that, I think as we continue down the road of analyzing this issue, we need to consider all debt. I mean, whether it's a first mortgage, a second mortgage, a line of credit, reverse mortgage, because what we don't really care what the instrument is. What we care is having enough equity in there to repay the program, and I think that's how we should look at it.
And we have not asked that question because it was not in the statute. So that's further information that we would have to ask in order to derive. Further questions or comments?
Just one quick one. I this is obvious to all of us who've been working on this program, but the reality is that for 35 or 40 years, housing values in the United States and in Oregon have been climbing at an astronomical rate of, in the neighborhood of 0.5% to 1% a month. And that came to be seen as normal. That's the way things are. I'm sort of referring to what Representative Bence was talking about earlier. We're returning to normal, at the real normal, which is that housing values don't increase. Housing values during the whole time that was measured from 1890-something to about 1970, adjusted for inflation, housing values didn't change. And we're getting back to that now, it seems to me, very likely. If that's the case, this kind of a program is going to have to be set up much more carefully than the one needed to be set up in 1970. There are people who feel entitled to the program who, in fact, don't qualify for it. And that's it's a very hard thing to say because it's a real problem for people who have adjusted the way they live to this constant increase in the value of their homes, which is no longer there. I can assure, and I know that my co-chairs agree with this, that we are looking at every angle we can to try to figure out how to maximize the utilization of the program for the people of Oregon in a way that allows us to maintain its solvency. Because the fact is, we did a very good job of protecting something like half of the people who were in the program in the first place, who were actually going to be completely out of luck this year if we hadn't made those changes. Now the question is, can we actually increase the number of people who are able to benefit from the program? And we're working hard on that. I can also tell you that in the Ways and Means process, there is exploration going on for those who simply don't qualify, who will not be able to repay a loan. To consider the possibility that the state may be better off to help people pay some of their taxes than to force them into a different housing system which may cost the state more. That still leaves a lot of people out. But it is a result of the reality that the change in housing values is returning to the long-term norm, which is there is no change. You buy a house early in your life, you live in it for a long time and you sell it for about what you paid for it when you sell. That was the norm for most of the last century plus, and I think we're getting back to that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate
it. Thank you for making the point that I was going to make. Representative Benz, one quick point. We are way behind on our list.
For your indulgence, Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank the team of people that's working on this so hard. It's a hugely important effort. I very much appreciate those of you working so hard on it. But Representative Chair Barnhart's remarks prompt me to think of the fact that we should ask our Department of Revenue to look at those other programs that are built on the same assumption that housing prices are going to continue to go up. And what's coming to my mind is this 3% increase in property taxes that happens every year. And I think any of these things that are built on the assumed increase in housing values need to be looked at, and somebody needs to come back for revenue and say, oh, by the way, these assumptions may not be as valid as they much were. And that was the point I didn't articulate appropriately in my last remark.
And a point well taken, and one that I can tell you that there have been discussions about our property tax system, how it works and how it may not work going into the future, and that is something that this committee needs to start paying attention to, as well as the agencies, because I said we don't get in front of problems until they become crises. This is one we better get in front of, or we will be in crises. And thank you.
Yeah. One quick one. I thought I was done, but Representative Benz's remark leads me to the next one, and that is this. Unlike this program, which had no limitations built into it at all until we wrote the bill, the general property tax law does have a limitation built in, thanks to the legislature in 1997 and to Mr. Sizemore in Measure 47, and that is the real market value of the property establishes the maximum at which taxes can be assessed. And so the 3% you're referring to, of course, refers to the situations in which the assessed value is lower than the real market value. These numbers used to be very, very far apart because the assessed value increase was well below the inflation rate. And so counties and cities had to continually reduce their actual programmatic budgets. Now they're getting closer. We will hit that point when the increases that government needs in order to continue operating will not be available through the property tax because the assessed value and the real market value will be the same, and there will be no 3% increase.
And that is what is before our work plan. Thank you very much. I'm going to cut off this discussion for further discussions. As I said, we will be having public hearings. We are trying to set them up for January date. We will be discussing this in the regular session and welcome questions and input. Let's move on. We're getting behinder here, folks, and we're going to move on to the behinder. We're hurrying. This, by the way, you can see the black and blue marks on all of our backs from hearing from folks impacted by this. I think we are all extremely sensitive to it. Now let's go on to the road user fee concept development and how the Rough Tough Committee is doing. Another interesting topic, and we got our technology ready, and Mr. Witte is ready, and you want to introduce it, Mazin.
Sure. Madam Chair, this is the thing that we designed these topics to follow each other, but there is no pun with rough, tough after the first one. So in the last session, we had the user fee for highways. As we know, our road system and highways is funded through user fees, and the taxation system to fund those highways is basically based on the gas tax and the weight mile tax and fees, and at this time, as we experienced before, there is a change in this future that is coming, especially with the different type of vehicles and propulsion system for those vehicles. And you've wanted to explore even more with the future for allowing those technologies to contribute to the construction and maintenance of the highway system. So Jim Witte from the Office of Innovative Partnerships and ODOT have been working for a long time with these issues, and he's here to share some of these works and discussions that they've been with you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Whitty. I'm the manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. I'm pleased to be here today to present the work plan for the biennium of the Road User Fee Task Force and ODOT. I recognize the committees have various levels of knowledge on this, so this is a little bit challenging, but we'll work through that. As the House members will recall, last session we worked through a bill to have a road user charge on electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. The committee worked hard on it, ultimately did not go to the floor for a vote. But another bill did pass, House Bill 2138, passed both houses and signed by the governor, that made changes to the enabling statutes of the Road User Fee Task Force to add new criteria when the task force was recommending alternative funding pilot programs to ODOT. And this criteria is listed on the slide. It's essentially to advise the Road Use Fee Task Force to take these things into account when giving advice to ODOT on pilot programs. ODOT understands that the value of preparing a new pilot program will demonstrate some of the methods for collection of a road usage charge. So those questions that were asked during the session, we'll have answers for in a demonstration model. Nevertheless, before ODOT was able to undertake a pilot program, the task force had to adopt the new criteria. And what they did was, is they looked at, on October 5th of this year, they looked at the bill that the House Revenue Committee passed out, 8-0. And said, let's look at that bill to see if they ought to have the task force ought to alter its policies, and it did. And so, these were the changes to the policies that the Rough Tough adopted. They took out the rates for later because the rates are not important to development of a pilot program. It's simply something work to be done later. I don't know that there's great need to go through all this, but it's there if we want to do it. The pilot program and the research and development we're going to be doing over this course of this biennium will answer central questions that came up during the session, and these are the kind of boiled down to these I list on this slide. How quickly will highly fuel-efficient vehicles become a significant part of the Oregon's fleet? That'll be very relevant to a new revenue system, and when it should start. And then something we discussed at great length here in this room is what are the methods, and to define those well so that everyone knows what they are for collection. And then is a non-electronic or a non-onboard technology reporting method viable? And how much will it cost and how difficult will it be for the motors to report their mileage and pay the charge? Those were questions that were asked, and those are good questions. Can we ensure privacy will be protected? And what will be the fiscal impact to ODOT to implement and administer the charge? And will private companies come forward to participate? So these are the questions. If we can answer these, we'll be better off next session. I'm looking towards 2013 at this point, in moving forward with legislation. So those that have followed this issue over the years will know that ODOT tested a GPS receiver-based system in 06 and 07. What we were doing is we adopted the engineer's approach to designing something, which is you go into a back room and you get a bunch of smart people and you design something and you think it's wonderful and you go out and show everybody and say, this is it. And then we did that. You know, it didn't work. It was wonderful, but it didn't work because the public said, we don't like it. We don't like what you've chosen. So what we've done in the years since is say, let's adopt the public acceptance approach. Let's listen to the public and give them a number of options for reporting their mileage and collecting a charge so that we can keep it simple for each one of them. I've had people tell me, keep it simple. But when I ask them what simple is, you know, it varies. So this opportunity here to give them multiple options for reporting their mileage and paying their charge will potentially resolve that issue. So what we have here, this is what we're investigating in the research. And the first two, the onboard electronic reporting options, the House members are remember from last session. The basic, which is the wireless transfer of the mileage directly from the odometer. And by the way, I've learned something. Progressive and Zipcar already have this technology and use it now. That's interesting. I didn't know that during the session.
Hmm.
And then the advanced.
Progressive meaning the...
Progressive insurance.
Insurance.
Yeah.
Huh.
Advanced would be the wireless transfer of mileage data from an onboard unit with vehicle location capability. So like a GPS unit, for example. And something else I've learned since the session. The Chevy Volt already sends the mileage data to the home computer through the internet for their access right now, the owner of that vehicle. And so does the Nissan Leaf. So what I'm saying is this technology is also evolving into the cars right now. The other reporting options, however, because not everyone will want those first two, is a potential for a flat annual tax that purchases unlimited mileage. So I don't want to report my mileage. I don't want to worry about it. I simply want to buy the maximum amount of mileage, and you can choose this option. And then the final option that we're investigating is self-reporting. This might involve an online form that's intelligent that will be able to tell whether there's an error made and be able to see if with trends whether somebody's reporting inappropriately. So we do not know whether all these options will be viable from an administrative standpoint. Will they be cost effective? And that's what we're investigating over this period of time. Okay, I'll go over the strategic plan now. The first task of the strategic plan is technology and research and development, and to identify and refine the technical solutions for mileage reporting. And this will principally focus on the first two options, the location and non-location based means of recording and reporting mileage. So we'll examine the technologies for onboard units. And we're actually hiring MIT to do this, to do this work. It's not the bulk of it, but it's just simply to determine exactly how the data transfer part would work. And then ODOT will specifically evaluate a cloud-based approach for mileage data transfer. So that means that the information would go into the cloud, the internet cloud is called. So that would be on provider's server, and then they would transfer that or translate that into the format that can feed into ODOT's computer, and then send it at the direction of the motorist, should they choose. The information developed in our research and development will inform the technology options. And then it will be tested in the pilot test we want to start next September. And then there'll be follow-on testing from that. And the pilot testing, we're hoping to involve mostly insiders, potentially some ODOT people. I'll certainly be involved with that. But we're inviting legislators as well to participate. Of course, there's one thing you make note. If you're interested, you'll be paying a mileage charge, and you'll be getting a refund or an offset for the gas tax. So you'll be on a new system if you opt in. To do that, though, we have to develop a concept of operations for the pilot, and we'll conduct an industry forum in the spring, where we'll bring forth or invite those companies that may well participate in providing the technology for the pilot, and then potentially later. Also, we'll do a financial and economic model to determine the estimates of the cost of startup and operations for the various collection scenarios, a benefit cost analysis, and then revenue projections. This won't be one number. It'll probably be a bound, so it'll be upper and lower. This will also involve forecasting the market penetration of highly fuel-efficient vehicles. The result will be the development of an economic operations model that will simulate costs for whatever eventual collection system that the legislature authorizes. We'll also develop a procurement strategy to determine whether ODOT can and how well we can outsource the technology data management tax collection activities to the private sector. And then certification as well, to define the duties of an independent contractor as a certification agent to ODOT. And then the as well, ODOT has to organize itself for such a new collection system, and that there'll be work done with an organizational framework and model for that purpose that's cross-dimensional. We'll engage in communications during this time. Stakeholder outreach, that has begun. We had an electric vehicle stakeholder meeting on Tuesday. So that's the work plan. Central to the work plan, though, is evaluation of the pilot, which will happen concurrently and then following the pilot test, and that's what we'll provide the legislature in 2013. And these are the there is a next slide. It doesn't want to come up. There they are. These are the evaluation criteria that will be applied to the pilot project. They were considered by the Road User Fee Task Force on October 5th and adopted. And there are quite a number of them. There's no point in going through all of them, but they're there for your use and understanding. And I believe they will tell us how well we've done in R&D work in the course of the next 14 months. That concludes my testimony.
Questions, Mr. Witte?
Have you looked at an expected analysis to determine at what miles per gallon a traditional car pays more under our existing model versus a mileage-based model?
If, Madam Chair, Representative Wan, if you're talking about the midpoint, that's been, of course, changing over the years. I think right now it's about 21.6 miles per gallon. If you're looking at a flat rate mileage charge. As you recall, during the session, though, we were talking about electrics and plug-in hybrid electrics, which are well above that midpoint. But I also understand that the legislature can add whatever vehicles it wants to this system, and it's not under my control at all.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Thank you. We are convening, the RUFTUF is convening later today.
Yes, Madam Chair, the RUFTUF is convening at 12:30 today.
We'll try and be there.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're getting a little bit of ahead now. We're making up time. Mr. Witte, thank you very much for the concise nature of your testimony. We have a report on the impacts of Measure 66 and 67. Paul, are you the...
Chris has been putting in a lot of time on this. So
we all have
over the last
out?
3 years. You should have it in your packets. So the first page is Measure 67 analysis, and then there's a Measure 66 after that.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Okay, Chair Berger and Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And as Paul just noted, you should have two one-page handouts in your packet. And I thought I'd talk about Measure 67 first, because we're just now getting the first look at the 2009 tax returns. As the committee is aware, there's a lag on the corporate returns. So I was going to talk about that first, and then there's an update on the Measure 66 analysis. So just reading down from on the handout, there is an update for the 2009-11 revenue impacts. According and it includes all the pieces of the tax increases there. And for the total, back in the estimate that was made during the 2009 session, for the 2009-11, the estimated revenue impact was $261 million, with the different pieces coming there from the minimum tax on C corporations, S corporations, and partnerships, as well as the marginal rate increase. And the 2011 update is $249 million, or 96% of that original estimate. And the new information here, aside from the economic landscape, is the being able to benchmark some of these numbers for the 2009 returns. And you can see there the different pieces. It was pretty much the same story across the board. The minimum tax for C corporations came in, or looks like it's coming in at about 98%. S corporations, 96%, and partnerships, 86% for the minimum tax. The part of the reason for the divergence there on the partnerships, once this fee was imposed, the Department of Revenue was finding a lot of partnerships who were filing returns that didn't need to be filing the returns. And so the historical data on which the estimates were based included a lot of returns that didn't need to be there. So once it came time to file and pay $150 minimum tax, realized, well, if we don't have to pay the tax, we're actually not supposed to be filing the return. And then the S corporation was off a little bit. The growth in the number of S corps was a little bit less than we had expected. So then moving down, so that's an update of the 09-11 impacts. And again, this update isn't final because we don't have 2010 returns or even 2011 returns for us to look at to find out what the actuals will be. And again, there's a significant time lag. But the information we do have now is in that middle table there for tax year 2009. And the total estimated collections from tax year 2009 was, let me back up a minute. I was focusing on the tax returns. The other piece was the Secretary of State corporate registry fees. And the forecast there was $26 million, and it came in at about $21 million. And almost all of that difference was due to the delay in implementation. The estimates assumed that the fees would begin being collected in October after the end of session, but when the measure was referred to the ballot, there was a delay in that implementation. And so those few months, the tax was not, or the fees were not collected for those few months. So then moving down into the middle table here, we're just talking about the tax returns. And so for tax year 2009, the estimate was about $113 million, with 47 coming from the graduated minimum tax, about 50 from the rate, and then $8 million from each of the S corporate minimum tax and the partnership minimum tax. And pretty much across the board there, you can see that the total collections were $110 million, or it came in just 2.5% less than the projection. And these are hard data from the returns. I do have a note on there that these are returns processed through the end of October. The department, there is a very long tail to these returns, but I don't expect these numbers to change very much from this point on. But there tend to be additional returns that come in. But this is our first opportunity to get a pretty close look there. Then the bottom table is an update on the biennial impacts. In the 2009 session, the estimates I made were just for the three biennia, the 09-11, 11-13, and 13-15. Since that time, the state economist has lengthened their baseline forecast 10 years, so now that gives me a benchmark on which to base these forecasts. And so, as I mentioned before, the 09-11 impact is now at 249, and it stays relatively constant. In 11-13, it's down to 240, and then stays right in the neighborhood of 220 to 230 there on out. And the difference is there from that original forecast in 2009. As I said, the 09-11 is 96%. The 11-13, I've dropped 11 points. So that forecast now is at about 89% of that original estimate, due to a combination of being able to benchmark the collections for the tax year 2009 returns and the economic landscape. So those are kind of the bottom line numbers.
Questions on the front page before we go to the next page?
Just a very quick comment. Congratulations. Lots of things have happened in the meantime, and you hit it very, very, very close.
It's surprising.
No, Chris, I think you need to take it.
Take credit.
I will admit to being, when I saw your numbers, I was in the room, Chris, I was very skeptical of the numbers. And this should be some validation of your methodology, and it gives us great confidence in the future when we get these numbers, that our staff is able to do the right research and the right analysis. So thank you.
Thank you. And we'll continue to look at it.
I like it too much.
The back page, and in lieu of the time schedule, on the back page, their estimates, there are two tables there that I won't go into detail, but you can look at in more detail if you like. provides a sectoral breakdown and the by-sales category for both the minimum tax collection and the marginal rate. And the bottom line is what I described for 2009, but this just provides some of the detail. And the story here was that nothing really jumped out in terms of one sector being way off or way under. Everything was pretty close. There were some offsetting cases where, for example, by the sector, the holding companies, the management company for the minimum tax, the amount came in was a little bit higher, and it was under for other sectors. Hmm. So the theme here is, however we've sliced the estimates, not only was the total estimate pretty close, however I slice it, it was pretty close. The bottom chart here is something we're paying attention to, and this would be the conversion of corporations from a C status to an S status. And going from 2000 to 2008, you can see it was relatively stable at around 600 a year. The one thing that is a little bit surprising, in 2009, the number was only 400. It actually fell. And my best theory at the moment for that has to do with incomplete data. Typically, again, due to the tail of these returns, the second year that the Department of Revenue releases corporate returns, for both C and S corporations, there tends to be an uptick of about 2 or 2.5%. So I wouldn't be surprised at all in a year from now that 2009 number, which is just over 400, will be a good bit over 500 or so.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because of the built-in gains and all the other parameters involved in the decision to go from a C to a S, I mean, there's so many decision points to be made in that structuring that transaction. Why are you looking at that? I mean, what's the benefit you're getting from that knowledge?
Chair Berger, Senator Telfer, as with many of the decisions, there are myriad factors that play into it, and oftentimes it is extremely difficult to get at the why for some of these.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the issues that did come up in the policy discussions about a minimum tax or changing the tax structure would be how many corporations could switch from C to S. Mm-hmm. And so this is by no means the end-all or be-all as to a causal factor. It's just trying to let the committee know that we are looking at the information that we have available. It is very indirect and macro-level information where the drivers behind the behavioral impacts tend to be very micro-level.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been an issue of interest. I've gotten a lot of questions about C to S conversions at a broad level, and this is simply a top-level piece of information that we're able to look at.
Well, I would just be very cautious of us as a committee trying to utilize that information in making any kind of decisions because, like I say, there are so many different parameters as to why somebody might choose to wait or do it now and know that 10-year building. I mean, there's just too many things to even make that a relevant piece of information for any decision that we might proceed with.
I will tell you that, Senator, this comes up all the time. Well, they're just going to switch.
Yeah,
so I think the question is, what is the trend on the switching is an appropriate one, and I think this high-level analysis is useful because he's going to get asked anyway. He might as well provide the information.
Well, the caution I would have, though, is those people that are just saying they're going to switch, they don't understand the transaction to begin with. And so for us to try to respond to that uninformed statement to begin with, it's just more misinformation and more information that has no value.
Yeah. Point well taken. Representative
Ayer. I was just going to say, you had mentioned that the downward trend to only hovering around 400 of these conversions is because of incomplete data. But if the motivation that we're trying to capture is the toggle between Measure 67 versus capturing the minimum rate, the income tax increase on the individual level with Measure 66, and that would be the primary purpose for tracking this data, I would say that as the economic downturn has happened and actually increased, there may be less of an effective, sales have come down. The minimum tax from 67 would have come down, and there was less motivation between that toggle to actually convert. As the economy comes back, And if 67 and 66 are still in place, as the economy comes back, we might see the normal trend come back, because then that toggle may be actually more meaningful. So I'm not sure that it's just because we don't have complete data yet. It might actually be the economic impact.
Chair Berger, Representative Brewer, I agree completely. I didn't mean to indicate that there's the one factor. And to Senator Telfer's point, I don't believe this one data point is a trend, and it doesn't tell the whole story. There is, as you are aware and have just commented, it's very complicated. There are myriad factors that play into it.
Well, one thing that's happening that is, you know, you're writing off bad debt on your receivables, so you don't have a lot of built-in gains. There's not a lot of appreciation. You don't have built-in gains. So it's not, I mean, that's just one of them.
And I'm sure that the CPAs would like to pursue this further.
Yeah,
it's exciting stuff.
And we'd encourage them to.
And we would encourage them to. I'm sorry.
Well, you're the one that put it on the agenda.
And it is interesting. And I'm further interested in the Measure 66 analysis. So, Chris, would you go on? And I'm going to get beat up either way.
Yeah. Okay.
If the CPAs don't get me, the lawyers will.
Okay, moving. So that was the one pager for 67. The second pager is an update on Measure 66. And I probably put this in a different order, or should have put it in a different order, because I have it starting off with the annual impacts, because now we had last year at about this time, I was able to provide information on 2009. That's updated a little bit, but it didn't really change. This is our first look at 2010 tax returns. And so here the forecast in the 2009 session was about $215 million for 2010. And last year, updating that projection, I pegged that at about $135 million. And looking at it this year, where we're actually looking at returns, at least returns processed through the end of October, my estimate is $143 million. Now, of that $143 million, $124 of it is actually showing up on the returns that we've seen. I have the $143 basically adjusting that $124 million based on the experience with the 2009 returns. The 2009 returns that we got through the end of October and adjusted to what we eventually saw for the 2009 returns. So that $143 is an estimate. And so you can see from the 2009 numbers, they were a good bit lower, but compared to last year, they're actually up a little bit, so they're tracking pretty well compared to the estimates last year. The middle table there provides just a couple of statistics that I get asked about a lot, and for both years, we have the mean and the median impacts from Measure 66. And the mean for both years is about $3,600, $3,700, and the median impact is right around the $850, $860 mark. And that chart in the middle shows the three graphs of the projections back in the 2009 session. That blue line, the top line, shows what my estimates were at the time. There was a significant downward adjustment last year, and that is reflected in the red line. And then the green line are the most recent updates. So things seem to be settling down, at least in terms of expectations moving forward. And then the bottom table there are the biennial impacts. I've just been able to extend those out to 2019, 2021. The differences there, again, not a big change from last year at this time. But that's the latest forecast tacking onto the 10-year forecast. And the last page on the other side, again, is some indirect information that I get questions about a lot. And there isn't a piece of this that's definitive, but I'm trying to highlight or describe some of the scenarios or the context for the income tax. The first chart there is what I've described as high income churning, and these are basically the high income tax filers. And for purposes of this, high income is defined as 125,000 single, 250,000 joint, basically the Measure 66 income levels. And when we look year over year, the number of taxpayers who move into or out of that category of income, these can be people that moved away, certainly, where they show up, they have a return one year, and then they're gone the next. They can also move up and down the income stream. And that's what's important in terms of trying to peg the impacts for legislative changes or even the revenue forecast. And what we see by that blue line is each year, roughly about 40% of these high-income filers were not high-income filers the year before. Similarly, the red line shows those that are gone, and it has reached above 40, but it's closer to 30% where those who were high-income filers one year were not high-income filers the next year. And I label this churning because it gets pretty complicated, because you can have a two-year impact or a three-year impact. You can have somebody who's high-income for 3 years and they're down 1 year. This is just kind of the first-order effect.
Yeah.
It can get very complicated very quickly. And even the notion of high income would be debated. And it can be somebody whose change in income is as small as $50, because you go out right as soon as you cross that border. So without trying to put together a PhD dissertation on the notion of high income churning, again, it's just a kind of a high level look at the complications of these taxpayers. The middle chart is a notion of the income that's involved with these folks. And the blue line are, again, I've labeled existing. These were high-income taxpayers who were high-income taxpayers the year before, and that still is the majority of the income. And the red bars are the new income, if you will, each year. And, of course, the taxpayers who were lost, that would be zero at the high income because they've left that category.
Run that by again.
The top chart has new and lost taxpayers, and we can identify those. They're new because we see the return in 2010 as a high-income filer. They were not a high-income filer in 2009. So in 2009, they either didn't file a return or they were not in that high-income category. So they're new to that category. We can identify the lost taxpayers because in the year before, in 2009, we can see these are the high-income filers. In 2009, we can look for those SSNs in 2010, and they are not in that high income group. They are either they either filed a return, but not in that income group, or they've left the state and have not filed a return.
Those are the lost.
The lost.
And then the middle chart, the new means that the people who are new to the high income tax bracket.
Right. And again, the theme here is just some of the volatility or the in and out of the high income level.
Uh-huh.
Again, the forecast, you know, I'll leave it at that. And then the last change, the last chart here is based on federal data and shows the capital gains. I think whenever we talk about this, I think I'm obligated to talk about capital gains income. It's almost part of the law somehow. So this is my capital gains chart for the day. And this shows the reported capital gains income change from 1 year to the next. So that first block is capital gains income comparing 2007 to 2008. And the blue chart, the blue bar is Oregon, and Oregon capital gains declined by over 50% that year. And then the U.S. on average for going from 2007 to 2008 was just under 50%. And then I put the neighboring states here, and they were all close to, they're all between the 40 and 50% mark. And then the next block of bars is the change from 2008 to 2009. And again, still significant losses in the 2 years. Again, not a story that you're unfamiliar with. I mean, you've been dealing with this for a couple of years. The Oregon fell again by just about 40%. It was less than the U.S. average, which was about 45% for that year. So again, this is, I often get questions about this information and capital gains realizations in Oregon as well in neighboring states in the U.S. on the whole, and this is just that information.
Just to clarify, you said capital gains realizations, but you're really talking about the recognition of capital gains, not just change in value of capital assets. You're talking about capital assets that were actually disposed of and reported on the taxable return.
Chair Berger, Representative Murray, that's correct. This is the capital gains that gets reported on the 1040.
If I may follow up on a statement, which is highly discretionary behavior by the taxpayers. and isn't really an indication of overall wealth or behavior in a recession or increasing economy. I mean, there's different behaviors in this. Again, very a lot of moving factors into taxpayer behavior on capital assets.
Further questions on this data?
Just that caution, because some of these discretionary decisions and what you've just given us, I would hate to see us rely on using some of this information as if it was some determination of because it is very variable, and it isn't doesn't have to do necessarily with the economy or anything like that. So just a caution on how we use this information.
I think that our staff is reacting to the fact that they get asked these questions a lot, and anticipation. He has the data available, and I appreciate it. We understand the caution very well in this committee.
And I really do appreciate the caution of our two CPAs, because it's really easy to misuse data as to think it means something that it doesn't mean.
Right.
And that's what you're telling
right.
us.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
We are going to land this plane very close to on time. The only thing we have left on our agenda is our work plan and going forward. Paul?
Yes, Madam Chair, and if I could comment on our CPA's comments about the capital gains, those are the very reasons why it's so difficult to project.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so, I mean, you just hit the nail on the head why it's been such a source of fluctuations for our revenue stream. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have been working on a set of bill draft requests for February. The co-chairs met a few weeks ago, and we talked through what is on our list. And so what you have in your packet is just a one-page outline of what we have in the works now, and we've gone through and made some divisions of responsibility among the two committees. And if you see on that list, number one is modifications to the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program. So, of course, you'll be developing what that concept is, but we will have a placeholder bill. We've been working with DOR, too, about technical changes that may help them going forward. We've also met with the Department of Energy, and they have some suggestions based on the changes, particularly to the renewables program. And Chris has also gone through back through House Bill 3672, which, of course, as you recall, had a lot of changes to it. And basically, this looks like a cleanup bill at this point. There are some policy issues we've identified that we'll need to bring to your attention. The other thing I would add is that, and I know that the chair, particularly Chair Barnhart's been interested in the auction results. We have gotten some discussion with Department of Revenue on that, and that may be something you may want to look at, too, as making some modifications. One of the things we plan to do for the January meeting is to give you, put that on the agenda, have some discussion about how that first auction went for the Department of Energy's renewable grant program. So,
and that would fit in the relating clause we're likely to use?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, that's our thinking, is that it would be including policy changes there, too, if you want to go in that direction. We also have had a request for the transient lodging tax, expanding that to residential facilities and linking that to federal payments. And we did have a bill last session, House Bill 2012, and we have that on our list. The last item we have is a committee bill for the House Revenue Committee is our standard reconnect bill. Remember, you are in the rolling reconnect phase now, and most federal tax base issue changes, but there are always definitional changes. Right now, we don't see a lot, but if you think about over the last couple of years, December has been an active month for Congress. I don't know if that'll happen this time or not, but that's something to be aware of. And our thinking on this is that we introduce that concept in both committees, both House and Senate committees, to give you some more flexibility. We've also identified three bills for introduction in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. The first is in working with Department of Revenue. They are, as you know, been working on a major new information system project. and they have talked about some performance contract, and there may be some additional language that they need, and we're working with them to help them help facilitate that project. There's also been an issue around a centrally assessed property, particularly in Central Oregon, and so we have a placeholder there to try to clarify the focus and the relationship of that centrally assessed property to enterprise zones. And then the last one there is a bill that was introduced by Senator Morse in the last session, Senate Bill 818. There's been quite a bit of work on that, and there'll be a modified form of that to be introduced in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Your dates, we have until December 5th to make those bill draft requests, so we'll be meeting with council over the next week or two and getting those ready. They'll be back to you by January 9th. And then introduced during your January days. One thing you might note, too, is that there are five bills per committee allowed, and we have, if you add those up, you have four each. So there's a wild card out there for each committee.
Well, I think that we all know the quick timeline we're going to be operating under. A number of you have mentioned to me, and I presume to other co-chairs, concepts of that might be in the works that apply to this committee that are under your personal bills. We would be welcome to hear from you as to what you want the committee to be dealing with. One thing that I frankly took off the table was if you recall, the discussion in the middle of the last session on prepaid wireless 911 tax. I said I would be working on it in the interim. I actually have convened work group of the folks involved, and in the process of that, our legislative council became fully engaged and submitted to me a council opinion, which I am happy to share with all of you, that basically says that our current statute basically already requires prepaid cell phones. That a statutory change in that is not necessary. There might be some clarifying language, but that it is in essence already in statute, which was sort of the discussion that we were having, how to put that in statute or what format. Well, this is a very strong legislative council opinion, and so acting on that, I said, well, then I don't need to submit a legislation that would do that, since our council says that it is already there. Now, that being said, there may be other proposals coming forward to change the way that it works or further discussion on it, but I didn't see it as a committee bill in light of this very strong opinion from council. And I'm welcome to share it, to contact my office if you'd like to see it. Okay.
Just one, if I could, just a really quick comment on, we don't really have a lot of time to discuss today, but representatives Berger and I will be finalizing our list. We do have room for one more item, so please, if you have an item that you believe ought to be on the committee agenda, get in touch with Paul and with us quickly, because we'll have to finalize that no later than December 5th.
Well, Madam Chair, if you have one more item, why don't we just do Measure 50?
We'll consider fixing Mr. Sizemore's bill. Huh?
Anything further? Any further questions? Thank you very much for your indulgence. The House Committee is adjourned.
Senate Finance and Revenue is adjourned. Thank you.
Okay, right.